Earlier this month, President Trump issued a proclamation limiting those seeking asylum to legal ports of entry only. But on Monday, in a strong rebuke to the Trump administration, a federal judge ordered the White House to start accepting asylum requests no matter where someone enters the country. The president has repeatedly referred to Central American migrants who are fleeing persecution as
an invasion. It's like an invasion.
But President Trump isn't alone in his rhetoric against migrants. Over the weekend, similar calls for deportation came from a few miles south of the U.S. border in Tijuana. Hundreds of Mexican protesters met the arriving Central American migrants with calls for Article 33 of the Mexican Constitution, which allows for the deportation of any foreigners. Some directly referenced the words of President Trump. Donald Trump was right, the protester says. It's an invasion. What Donald Trump said is true. And more of these caravans are coming, and they're only terrorists. That's what they are. But many of the changing attitudes towards migration within Mexico precede the Trump presidency. And that's where we start today. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Maureen Meyer works for the Washington Office on Latin America, and she's the director for Mexico and migrant rights there. Maureen, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So how surprising are these protests, and how much do we know about who the protesters were?
I think that the protests are fairly surprising, given how much support we've seen for members of the caravan during their entire journey through Mexico. Many people in southern states, the poorest parts of Mexico, offering them food, helping to take care of them while they were on their journey. And so I think it is surprising to see so much outpouring of frustration and xenophobia towards this population. It seems in part fomented by a lot of fake news being circulated on social media in Tijuana about the members of the caravan being members of criminal groups, bringing crime, as well as the mayor of Tijuana, who has certainly helped foment this by talking about the migrants in ways that would say that they're invading, that they're a risk to the Tijuana population.
How much of the current American climate is influencing what we hear? I mean, this was a protest in our introduction who was clearly referring to President Trump's rhetoric.
I think people in Mexico follow Trump a lot. They're very upset most of the time by what he says, how he characterizes Mexicans. You remember the idea that Mexicans are criminals, they're rapists. And so I think it certainly is something that Mexicans see. And in this case, it seems that the mayor, who has a hat that also says Make Tijuana Great Again, has taken on that same role of using migrants, criminalizing migrants, often for political gains and for posturing in terms of his own politics and what he wants for his city.
Let's talk a little bit about the numbers. Of course, we know that, I guess the question is migration to Mexico up? And if so, could that also be driving some of this?
Mexico has been a transit country for decades of people, much more in the recent years of Central Americans. It's estimated around 400,000 Central Americans and others from different parts of the world use Mexico as a way to travel to the United States. But Mexico is increasingly being a destination country. We have seen asylum requests increase by more than 500% since 2014. Over 14,000 people requested asylum in Mexico last year. The similar numbers this year so far. And so I think Mexico is more and more a destination country in a way that hasn't been in the past, particularly for Central Americans.
Is that because, in part, of the United States' recent stance, the President Trump's administration's stance on immigration? Are people just saying, we'll stay here versus even trying to attempt crossing the U.S. border?
I think that's certainly part of it. It's a more viable option, and Mexico's definition of who might qualify for asylum is actually broader than the United States, so that's also part of it. But we look at the way that the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has also worked to educate migrants about their rights, how they might qualify for asylum. Mexican civil society organizations are also working to support potential asylum seekers. So I think there's more awareness also from Central Americans that they could qualify for asylum in Mexico. And there are places where people are settling, including in northern Mexico and states like Coahuila, which is on the U.S.-Mexico border as well. And people start to feel that, you know, Mexico is a place where they can be safe and raise their families and not have the same fear that they had back home.
You mentioned the mayor of Tijuana, and we know that the mayor has referred to migrants as a quote-unquote horde of folks, that he didn't want them in his city. He's also called upon federal authorities to help with the situation. Is this an incident that's isolated to Tijuana, given the mayor's approach to the migrants? Or is this something that we're going to start to see more broadly across Mexico?
We have not seen it yet anywhere else so far. I think the unique situation of Tijuana, though, is it has become the main destination for many asylum seekers. So before the caravan arrived, you already had around 3,000 people waiting for their turn to have an appointment with U.S. officials to request asylum. That backlog's about a month. So I think it's part responding to the number of people. But it is likely not... it's probably likely an isolated case. I think the mayor himself has been negative towards immigrants in the past, including the Haitians that arrived in Tijuana a few years ago. There also have been against Mexicans that have been deported to Tijuana, framing them as criminals as well. We've seen that in other parts of the U.S.-Mexico border, particularly in terms of Mexicans being deported. But I don't think we've seen ever this level of characterization of migrants as an invasion or not wanting them there that we see right now with the mayor of Tijuana.
We're seeing a lot of, just across the world, we're seeing refugees and migrants trying to enter different countries, not just in Mexico. And I'm wondering, are you seeing this as part of a more global trend, that there are citizens across the world who are turning their backs on migrant or refugee populations?
I think certainly it is part of a broader trend. We see it obviously in the United States with a president who's seeking to limit as much as possible legal ways for people to request asylum in the country. I think Mexico is going through growing pains of being a country that has historically sent migrants. I mean, Tijuana itself is a city built by migrants, many of them who have been returned from the United States, to becoming a country that's receiving much more migrants. And it is a country that, given its size, has a very small immigrant population. And so I think it's part of those adjustments to a global phenomenon of people moving throughout the world seeking protection, that Mexico, as other countries, including in Central American countries, Costa Rica, Panama, are also going through, given the ongoing violence and instability in the Northern Triangle countries of Central America.
Maureen Meyer is the Director for Mexico and Migrant Rights for the Washington Office on Latin America. Maureen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Some of the first Central American migrants to make it to the U.S. border were a breakaway group of about 80 lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals, many of them fleeing violence and discrimination in their home countries because of their sexuality. Eric Duran of Honduras and Pedro Pastor of Guatemala made a public display of their love over the weekend by tying the knot amid cheers from other migrants.
And really, this is a dream come true, because in our countries you don't see this, and we have always wanted it. And today that we have this opportunity, very happy, really very happy.
So what's leading so many members of the LGBTQ community in Central America to flee? Diego Molina is a transgender man and a volunteer for Dique LGBTI in El Salvador. And he told me the daily risks of life are high.
I've experienced living in the U.S. and in Europe and here in El Salvador, and I can tell you there's no comparison. It's very hard to be out. Usually you cannot get a job. You're shunned from your family. It's really hard to access resources. The security angle is also very delicate, because for those whose gender presentation does not fall within conventional standards, it's a bit more difficult, a lot more difficult. Gang members have actually vowed to exterminate the trans population, and unfortunately, these individuals are easily identified. I can give you an example. There is a trans guy. He was 19 years old. He was part of our organization, and he was unfortunately murdered by gang members a couple of months ago. His family have now, they've become targets of the same gang, and they were forced out of their residence because they were being threatened, and they were about to join one of these caravans. Thankfully, we managed to bring them some help. One of our other LGBTQ organizations here, was able to relocate them and provide financial assistance, legal assistance, and they did not have to join the caravan, thankfully, but they were actually on their way out the door when we managed to bring them some aid.
So were you concerned about them participating in a migration north because they are more susceptible to harassment or violence in that journey?
It is a difficult journey. Typically, the issues that they face between here and the United States, they face kidnapping, rape, extortion, theft, trafficking. And even if they manage to make it, you know, there is no guarantee that they will receive a legal status once they arrive and that they will not be sent back.
And so tell us what type of work you do with that community in El Salvador.
Sure. So DK has a few functions here in El Salvador. The organization does civil rights advocacy. We also try to advocate for protection of civil rights advocates themselves, as they themselves have become targets of violence. We also have put a strong emphasis on education of law enforcement and government organizations on how to deal with LGBTQ people. And we also do some work with disability and research.
What is the stance of the El Salvadorian government?
There is a politic of silence when it comes to the LGBTQ community here from the government. It's a very touchy issue. They try not to address it. We don't have explicit rights. You can be fired for being gay or for being transgender. You can be denied housing. I've personally had issues with healthcare, showing up to a hospital and trying to get care for a bronchitis attack I had a couple of years ago. And I was not able to receive care from a doctor just because of the way that I looked. The Supreme Court did order the government to acknowledge the problem of forced migration in general, not just for LGBTQ people. In June, July, they actually ordered the government to introduce legislation that would address individual cases of gang violence that would require relocation. And the idea is that this new legislation would provide for legal and financial assistance to these victims so that they, you know, are not forced to leave their home country.
And if that legislation does not pass, are you concerned about the safety of LGBT El Salvadorians and even broader beyond the country?
Yes, we are. We have presidential elections coming next year. And as you know, you've experienced in the U.S. yourself, sometimes that can polarize things even more and people become targets due to political rhetoric. And so we do expect the issues to get a little bit tougher for the LGBTQ community with the new election cycle coming up. And, you know, it's a really easy talking point for some politicians to make, you know, to have a strong stance against what they consider to be evil. And this just, you know, stems from our religious culture here, our extreme religious culture here in El Salvador. We are deemed evil. You know, we are not going to go to heaven. We're going to hell. We are ruining families. And so that kind of rhetoric does incite new violence. So we're hoping that the administration will propose legislation that will encompass the community and the issues that we face, the violence issues that we face.
Diego Molina is a volunteer at DIKE LGBTI in El Salvador. Diego, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been featuring different LGBTQ stories from across the globe for the past week. You can listen back to all of our coverage at thetakeaway.org/LGBTQ rights. In 2017, 415 migrants died on the border. That's according to the International Organization for Migration. Harvard professor Yeva Yusonite has worked as an emergency responder in both northern Mexico and southern Arizona while conducting field work.
Some of the fire departments where I worked are in much more remote locations like Arivaca, where even to get to the hospital, it takes an ambulance maybe at least an hour, sometimes 2 hours, to take the patient to the hospital from those areas.
As of 2016, the U.S. Border Patrol has employed more than 4,100 first responders, 730 emergency medical technicians, and more than 70 paramedics. That response force is assisted by local fire departments, ambulances, and volunteers. But Yusonite says responders are often stretched thin.
In addition to everything emergency responders ordinarily do in any department in the country, here they are also placed on the front lines of these converging wars the government has declared.
Yusonite compiled that research into a new book called Threshold, Emergency Responders on the U.S.-Mexico Border.
What surprised me was to learn how routine traumatic injuries have become in towns along our country's southern edge. That is, ambulances are sent for wounded border crossers so frequently that emergency responders refer to the cement ledge abutting the fence or the wall, depends how you want to call it, as the ankle alley. So we saw a lot of leg and spinal, neck and head injuries, something that I was not accustomed to. People who try to walk around urban areas through more remote desert and mountain terrain usually suffer dehydration or have heat stroke. So it is the environmental conditions that eventually wound them. So as a scholar and an emergency responder, I just was surprised to learn such a simple fact. It would seem that the taller and longer fences have not deterred people from trying to get across, only increased the risk of serious injury and death.
What happens when someone who's crossing the border needs to get medical care? Does it matter if they're coming here illegally or seeking asylum?
People who are seeking asylum usually present themselves at the port of entry, and then they are taken in by the Border Patrol, who then call in the doctors or the ambulances. If it's an emergency situation where a person is found in the desert or somebody who falls off the wall, it depends who finds them first. Very often, because there is such a dense Border Patrol presence, it is the Border Patrol who find the injured people in the first place. They can provide some first aid, but they cannot transport injured people to the hospital. So that's when they call local emergency services, when they ask for an ambulance, sometimes a helicopter. But there are other situations when the Border Patrol are not the first one to get in contact with the injured border crossers. There are a lot of humanitarian volunteers in the area. A group called No More Deaths has a medical treatment camp not far from Arivaca, where some of these border crossers can go, and the Border Patrol has, or at least had, a policy of not going in and arresting people there. Sometimes local residents would call an ambulance, or if it's serious, or provide first aid. But usually, once they reach the hospital, that's where immigration services become involved. It didn't used to be that way up until early 2000s, let's say 2008, people would be taken to the hospitals and then they would leave. But now it's a little more blurred. The emergency responders are not in Arizona, are not allowed to ask for the patient's legal status. They don't ask for the person's social security number. They just provide that care to treat the injuries or deal with the illness that presents immediate threat to life or limb, and take care of the paperwork later at the hospital.
What struck you about what the workers were facing on a daily basis?
Well, these emergency responders notice how our different approaches to border security change the patterns of injuries. In the 1990s and early 2000s, the fence that was in the towns in southern Arizona was much shorter. It was 8 to 12 feet tall, but it had very sharp edges. So very often they would go to help injured border crossers who had their fingers amputated by the sharp edges of that fence. And now in 2011, that fence was replaced by a taller and sturdier bollard-style barrier that is in Nogales right now. It's about 20 feet tall, and people who fall off that fence have usually fracture their ankles or legs or spine, have head injuries. It's more of a multi-system trauma, which is perhaps a lot of emergency responders call the previous barrier inhumane, just because how bloody the injuries were. But now this is multi-system trauma. It will take months for people to heal. Looking at this from the perspective of emergency responders, it just shows how injuries change depending on what type of barrier we put on the border, but that people still try to come and risk injury and risk death. Over 7,000 people, and this is according to the Customs and Border Protection, so probably the numbers are much higher. Over 7,000 people have died trying to cross the border in the last 20 years. Some of these in the urban areas, even from falling off the fence or drowning in the drainage tunnels, others walking across the desert.
Is there a story that stands out to you, maybe a memory that you have from your time working on the border that you'd share with us?
Sure. I think when I was volunteering in the migrant aid center on the Mexican side of the border, it is just steps away from the border crossing from the major port of entry in Nogales, Arizona. In this aid center, we saw a lot of elderly people who were deported from the United States after having lived in Phoenix for several decades or elsewhere in the country, who had high blood pressure, had diabetes, and who had no life in Mexico. And all they wanted to do was go back to the United States. But it was so hard when they said, you know, can you give us a pill to help us walk? By that, asking for ibuprofen, which was the only medication that we could give them for their pain, and telling them that they need to drink a lot of water, and knowing that they would never be able to carry enough water for the days that the journey would take. There was a pregnant woman that I met at the aid center who climbed on the fence on the Mexican side, but then changed her mind and fell back into Mexico. She was, I think, several months pregnant, but she didn't want to go to the hospital in Mexico. And again, she just came to the aid center to ask for some ibuprofen. It was just very sad to see how many ways they were wounded and that the only way you could do for them was to give them ibuprofen.
Yeva Yusunite is a professor at Harvard University and the author of the new book, Threshold, Emergency Responders on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Yeva, thanks so much.
You are very welcome.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
The famous Brooklyn Bridge in New York City is experiencing more traffic than usual these days. Well, why does this matter to anyone besides New Yorkers? Well, every time officials transport a certain detainee to a Brooklyn court from a Manhattan jail, they have to shut the whole bridge down because of his track record of escaping. That detainee is Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. Guzman, or El Chapo, is known as one of the world's most powerful drug lords. He helped run the Mexican Sinaloa cartel for years, a criminal organization peddling drugs, money, and arms, until his capture in 2016. This is the second week of his trial, where he's facing 17 charges, including drug trafficking, conspiracy to commit murder, among others. Keegan Hamilton is the co-host of the Vice News podcast, Chapo, Kingpin on Trial, and he's been in the courtroom. Keegan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So give us a sense of the jury selection process, because I cannot imagine, I mean, being on a jury must be terrifying for these folks.
Yeah, it was very hard for them to find 12 jurors and 6 alternates who were willing to sit for this trial, which is expected to last anywhere from 3 to 4 months. It seemed like about 25% of the people said, no way, I'm not going to do this, and had some sort of excuse in mind, willing to get out. Another 25% were maybe a little too enthusiastic and wanted to be a part of something that they thought would be historic. And then half the people were sort of indifferent and or had no idea who Chapo was and just didn't quite understand maybe what they were getting themselves into.
And I'm wondering, what are some of the witnesses who are testifying against El Chapo? What have they had to say so far?
So far, there have only been 3 witnesses called. The first 2 were former law enforcement agents. But the star witnesses, the most important witnesses in this case, are going to be cooperators who have cut deals with the government or former associates or partners of Chapo. There's 16 of those who are expected to testify, and their identities are being kept secret. So far, we've had 1 take the stand, and that is the younger brother of El Chapo's partner, El Mayo Zambada. And he's offered some pretty inflammatory testimony, shocking stuff about bribery to basically every level of law enforcement in Mexico, murders that Chapo was allegedly responsible for, and sort of how the Sinaloa cartel was formed back in the day.
And we know that Chapo has escaped multiple times, which is why they have to shut down the Brooklyn Bridge. What are the security protocols in place, not just for El Chapo and making sure he doesn't escape, but also for the jurors?
So the jurors are anonymous. Nobody knows their names. The defense doesn't. The government doesn't. The judge doesn't know their names. And they are being escorted to court every day by U.S. marshals. They're not sequestered in the sense that they have to stay in a hotel for 3 to 4 months while this trial goes on. But they're not. They meet at a common place, and then U.S. Federal marshals bring them to the courthouse every day as a security precaution.
And is the defense for El Chapo is claiming that he's not gotten a fair trial so far. Where does that stand?
It's not so much that he's not gotten a fair trial. It's that he's been, you know, set up as the fall guy by the Sinaloa cartel. That was the crux of the defense's opening statement to the jury, saying this guy is not all he's made out to be by the government. There are other leaders of the Sinaloa cartel who found it convenient to blame El Chapo for every drug shipment, for every murder, for everything. And therefore, you can't trust the testimony of these cooperators who are about to tell you that Chapo is the one and only leader of the cartel.
And now the trial takes a break but comes back after the holiday. Is that right?
That's right. We're going to have a trial wraps up today, and then it'll go off through next week and starts on Monday and will run basically until late December around Christmas.
Keegan Hamilton is the co-host of the Vice News podcast, Chapo, and U.S. editor. Keegan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again.
The Mexican government's role in facilitating the growth of organized crime groups in that country is also at the center of El Chapo's trial, including bribes to top-level officials. In 2006, Mexico's government officially launched its war against drugs, with former President Felipe Calderón deploying troops to the streets to stomp out the cartels. The move was widely criticized as a failed strategy after the military itself was implicated in extrajudicial killings, torture, and sometimes even carrying out the work of organized crime groups, like with the highly publicized disappearance of 43 students in 2014. Mexico's president-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador will be stepping into office in December, and the future of the Mexican drug war is now in question. Stephen Dudley is the co-director for Inside Crime, a think tank based in American University that focuses on organized crime. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the security strategy that Mexico has employed. We mentioned that they've got military in the streets, but there's also been a strategy that the U.S. government also is behind called the Kingpin strategy. What is that?
This is a long-time strategy that focuses most of the resources the government has and the U.S. has towards targeting the highest level drug traffickers. So the thought behind it is that you really cannot establish the legitimacy of the government in question, in this case, the Mexican government, unless you can take out some of these very large drug traffickers that seem to be, in this case, sort of operating with impunity in a place like Mexico. So you focus all your resources on targeting, capturing, and or killing these particular targets, and then that's going to at least mitigate some of the power that these criminal organizations have.
As I'm sure you know, one of the arguments in the El Chapo defense here in New York during the trial is that the Mexican government is basically corrupt entirely at all levels, and that El Chapo was some sort of a pawn in the larger machine of Mexican politics. What's your take on that?
I think it's a little bit ridiculous to say that he was a pawn. On the other hand, you cannot operate a trafficking organization the size of the Sinaloa cartel without having tremendous connections inside of the government.
What about the U.S. government? What's its role been in this Mexican drug war? And has it been effective? I mean, I imagine not so much, but you're the expert. Tell me.
Well, if we're going to talk about amount of drugs going into the United States from Mexico, one could say it has not been effective. On the other hand, you know, these criminal organizations are responsible for subverting governments, democracies. They are responsible for huge numbers of murders. And you really do have to target them in order to debilitate them. And, you know, the emphasis of the United States has been targeting these higher level criminal organizations and these higher level criminals like Chapo. And in certain ways that it has had a positive effect. So, you know, both sides can argue that you know, without their efforts of going after criminal groups like this, then you would have a much worse problem. And, you know, the corruption, as bad as it is, would be even worse.
What are some alternatives? Are there alternatives?
Well, there are some alternatives, and this is the interesting thing with Mexico and other countries around the region, which is that they are experimenting with legalizing or at least decriminalizing certain types of drugs, such as marijuana. So there is some experimentation in pushing these markets from the underworld into the legitimate economy. And the notion is that that will lower levels of, you know, competition and ultimately violence, and that will also help move at least some of these illicit funds that go into campaigns and other ways that they subvert democracy, that will push it hopefully into a more, you know, open and transparent atmosphere. So that's the notion. It's very hard to say whether or not that alternative path will lead to a different result.
Stephen Dudley is the co-director for Insight Crime. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The campfire in Northern California is still burning. It's the deadliest and most destructive fire in the state's history. Dozens of people have been found dead so far, and the town of Paradise has almost completely burned to the ground. Amid the devastation, people are searching for answers to how the fire started, and equipment owned by the Pacific Gas and Electric Company may be at least partially to blame. Officials are investigating whether power lines owned by the state's largest utility started the fires. It would be the second time in 2 years the company is held responsible for a major wildfire. Ted Goldberg is the morning news editor for KQED in San Francisco, and he's been following the story. Ted, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what do we know so far about how the campfire started?
Well, CAL FIRE, the agency that's investigating the fire, has been pretty tight-lipped. They say that we're investigating all possibilities, and they include problems with electrical equipment in that sort of list of categories. We know that in the hours after the fire started, Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, filed an incident report with state regulators basically saying that there was an outage on a major transmission line about 15 minutes before the fire began in an area believed to be where the fire started. In fact, last Friday, they filed yet another document with the California Public Utilities Commission saying that there was another problem with a different line, this time a distribution line in an area of that's described as Concow. It's a community in Butte County, one of the communities that's been devastated, indicating that their distribution line also had an outage. This was about 30 minutes after the fire began in a similar area where Cal Fire says there may have been a second ignition point. So right now, there are a number of clues. These two incidents with PG&E infrastructure, Cal Fire is saying we're ruling things out, things like lightning. There was no lightning in the area, and arson. There's no evidence of arson. So a lot of us in the press are focused on the PG&E infrastructure in the area where the fire may have begun.
Now, of course, this isn't the first time that the PG&E infrastructure may have been responsible for starting a wildfire there. Can you take us back to the deadly North Bay fires from last year?
Well, last October, about October 8th, there were a series of wildfires that devastated Northern California. Here in our area, in the Bay Area, in Sonoma County and in Napa County and in Lake County, there were just neighborhoods that were destroyed and dozens of people lost their lives. And in a similar sort of situation here where our station is located in San Francisco, these were huge fires. They were fairly close to the Bay Area. There would be smoke that would be pouring in, you know, into the region. The state brought to bear a huge amount of resources to fight, you know, a large number of wildfires. The city of Santa Rosa, which is one of the Bay Area's largest cities, lost dozens and dozens of homes. And PG&E was blamed for about 16 of those wildfires. They also faced a number of lawsuits. The biggest fire, though, in that set of wildfires, the Tubbs Fire in the North Bay and in right north of San Francisco, Cal Fire has yet to release its findings on that. And we are sort of waiting and hoping that we'll learn more about, you know, what was the biggest blaze in our area last October.
Ted, what's really happening here? I mean, is it that PG&E is not taking care of the power grid as they should? Or is this just, I guess you could, that normal wear and tear of the grid and their inability to keep up with it? What's going on?
Well, you know, the weather is a major factor, and PG&E is fully aware of that. In fact, in the days before the fire, the big fire in Butte County, the Camp Fire, PG&E had warned customers in a number of counties, including Butte County, the weather coming up is going to be very bad. The wind is going to be very high, and it's possible we may have to turn the power down in advance. They did something like this in late October in a number of areas, and they actually got a bunch of criticism for it. And they warned people in advance, we may turn the electricity down. They decided not to do that. But to answer your question, you know, one of the major factors is not just making sure that their equipment is safe, but it's also putting in preventative measures. And in some cases, they get criticized if they do and if they don't. What's really going on right here is we have a major discussion about California's largest utility. PG&E is a part of the major fabric of the Bay Area, and we all rely on them here. So many of us do. But at the same time, they have been held responsible, not just for a series of wildfires like you pointed out last year, and their eyes of investigators are not just on the wildfires this year, but in several different incidents over the last few years, PG&E has been blamed for a number of disasters. You may remember in 2010 in San Bruno, a natural gas transmission line blew up, basically destroying a neighborhood. Last year in May, there was a refinery shutdown. It was a power outage. The state regulators ended up blaming PG&E. So there's a big discussion about what this means for the future of the utility and whether or not it may file for bankruptcy, whether or not it's appropriate that the state rely on a for-profit company for something as important as electricity and safety.
I mean, given the results, I can't imagine that the organization doesn't have more oversight. There isn't. Is there a body or an organization or a person that is supposed to have oversight on this? And if so, where are they?
So I've mentioned the name of the California Public Utilities Commission a couple times. They are the state regulator when it comes to utilities. After the San Bruno incident that I mentioned just a moment ago, they actually came under fire for not being a strong enough enforcer and regulator of PG&E. They're the ones that investigate whether or not PG&E is abiding by state utility regulations. And our eyes will be on that as a regulator. In fact, last week, Michael Picker, who's the president of the commission, the CPUC made comments to investors in one part of the day, basically reassuring them, I don't think that PG&E will have to file for bankruptcy. We don't want that to be the case. That ended up pushing up PG&E shares that had fallen after information released about this fire. But then in a statement to the public, he said, we are going to have to investigate this company and their safety culture. So our eyes are not just on PG&E, but they're also on this regulator that you mentioned.
We've got a couple seconds left in the segment. Has PG&E issued a statement to you? Have they said anything about this, or are they being pretty tight-lipped so far?
Well, you know, they emphasize that they're cooperating with investigators, that the cause of the fire is not yet known. And they do release information, in bits and pieces about their infrastructure. But for the most part, they're not releasing a large amount of information and not commenting. I think they're staying back and saying, look, you know, they are facing a number of lawsuits. They're facing a lot of scrutiny. And at this point, their public statements have been pretty short.
Ted Goldberg is the morning news editor for KQED. Ted, thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.